Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. The debate about higher education in America is raging on editorial pages, in state legislatures, and across kitchen tables, including here in Memphis. Some of our most famous entrepreneurs, like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, never got a college degree. Some insist college just needs to prepare students for the job market. In Michael Roth's new book, Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters, the president of Wesleyan University not only explains that this debate is as old as America itself, but makes a strong case for what he terms pragmatic liberal learning. Here's how he sums up his defense.
The mission of liberal learning in higher education should be to teach students to liberate, animate, cooperate, and instigate. Through doubt, imagination, and hard work, students come to understand that they really can reshape themselves and their societies. Liberal education matters because by challenging the forces of conformity, it promises to be relevant to our professional, personal, and political lives. That relevance isn't just about landing one's first job. It emerges over the course of one's working life. The free inquiry and experimentation of a reflexive, pragmatic education help us to rethink for ourselves, take responsibility for our beliefs and actions, and become better acquainted with our own desires, our own hopes. Liberal education matters far beyond the university because it increases our capacity to understand the world, contribute to it, and reshape ourselves. When it works, it never ends.
Michael Roth will be at Rhodes College to offer a free public lecture about why liberal education matters on October 23rd at 6 p.m. Today on Counterpoint, we get this conversation started. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Michael, you open your book throwing down a gauntlet. You write, Beyond the University argues that the demand that we replace broad contextual education meant to lead to lifelong learning with targeted vocational undergraduate instruction is a critical mistake, one that neglects a deep American tradition of humanistic education that has been integral to our success as a nation and that has enriched the lives of generations of students by enhancing their capacities for shaping themselves and reinventing the world that they will inhabit. Now, let's get started with making clear the terms of the discussion. What exactly do you mean by liberal education versus vocational education?
Well, vocational education is a training for doing a specific task. And the reasons for it are many. Often it's a task that will land you a job, the development of skills for a specific trade. It's the forming of a person's skills so that they can meet the requirement of somebody else's design, somebody else's task. And elements of vocational education can be very important for many people. A liberal education, as I've described it in this book, is an education that is broad, contextual, and integrative. What I mean by that is that you not only learn the skill, but you are coming to understand how that skill fits into context, into an economy, into a society, into politics. You are learning to situate yourself in the world and not just to perform somebody else's task. So I talk about liberal education not as a liberal arts education, which is a kind of an older European notion that you should learn things that you can do in your leisure time. And liberal arts tradition, very important though it is, really specified certain disciplines that you should know to be a gentleman, that you should know to be a well-rounded person. When I talk about liberal education in the American tradition, I'm talking about a way of learning that could be applicable to any discipline. And not that you have to learn Greek or that you have to learn history or you have to learn religion, but that whatever you're studying, you study it in context, you try to understand the concepts behind it, and you try to understand how to integrate what you're studying into what's going on around you.
So you're the president of Wesleyan University. This is a really select liberal arts institution like Rhodes. You actually did your undergraduate education at Wesleyan. You went on to Princeton. You've taught in a lot of private, elite liberal arts institutions. Why should the decision makers within higher education at places like University of Memphis pay attention to your argument?
This kind of education has been nurtured by elite private institutions in some important ways. But the devotion to a broad contextual education actually is part of the reason we have had for a long time deep public support for higher education for everyone who can finish their high school work. That's because a liberal education is important for the development of the capacity for citizenship. It's important for the development of creativity and critical thinking. These are not elements that are only relevant to people who go to elite private schools. They are relevant to anyone who is going to push back against oppression, who is going to critically evaluate their government, who is going to participate in their neighborhood. A liberal education is not just training in a discipline that is highfalutin or fancy or esoteric. A liberal education should empower you to make a contribution to your family and to your neighborhood and to the nation. And this American tradition is not one that only aims at the elite. It aims at the citizen who needs to think more generously and more critically in order to fulfill her role or his role in the country.
So what I want to do, though, is rehearse a little bit of some of the criticisms of that approach to education. A significant emphasis amongst those critics of general education is that it dilutes from the economic rationale of higher education. So they basically say, sure, we live in an information economy, but what education should really do is to equip people to play an appropriate role within the economy. We don't need bartenders who are careful readers of Shakespeare. The question is a non-monetized education a waste of money? If you can't directly make money from your education, isn't it just a bad investment?
I think it's actually a really bad investment to invest your time and your money into preparation for the worst job you'll ever have, which is the first job you'll get after you finish school. The point of an education is empowerment, as W.E.B. Du Bois said at the beginning of the 1900s. Empowerment, that includes work, that includes the things you're going to do for a job, but it's much broader than that. And in our society today, where people are unlikely just to have one job and stay with one employer, in our society today, where technological change is more rapid than ever before, in our society today, it makes no sense to have a narrow technical education only and be unable then to learn new things when those technologies become obsolete. You don't want a time stamp on your education. You don't want to get out of school knowing something that's going to become obsolete in the next 6 months or the next 2 years. An education should give you a greater ability both to adapt to changes and to shape those changes. So I want to stress this because it really isn't just for elites who don't have to worry about a job. I think that the American tradition of liberal education is very much a pragmatic tradition. So when Jefferson talks about education, he's talking about useful knowledge. When Ben Franklin criticized elite education at the beginning of our country's history, he was criticizing people who thought education was just a form of snobbery. You go to a fancy school, and then you come out and you can look down on other people. He was a great enemy of that. But he thought that education should be about open-ended inquiry and conversation about inquiry that brings you together with your neighbors, with people in other trades and other professions, thereby creating a more robust citizenry and a freer way of life, but also giving you more capacity to do stuff in the world, not just to look down on other people who are doing things.
So it seems as if the backdrop to this larger discussion has to do with anxiety about adaptation and change in the contemporary context. And some of that is being generated by new forms of technology and new forms of social media. One approach that we hear a lot about these days, for those of us who spend too much time reading things like the Chronicle of Higher Education and Inside Higher Education, goes by an acronym. It's called MOOCs, Massive Open Online Classes. And it may come as a surprise to some people that you've actually taught an online Coursera course and that you don't see any disconnect between this and your advocacy of a liberal education. Can you tell us a little bit about the experience of teaching and learning through such courses and why you actually found that liberal learning mattered sometimes more to those students, even than the students who you're teaching at Wesleyan?
But I thought that liberal education, not being tied to a specific set of disciplines or a specific mode of delivery, might intersect with these new forms of technology. And so I signed Wesleyan up with Coursera, a Silicon Valley company that also believes in learning by doing. What attracted me to Coursera was that they really felt that courses would get better not by extensive preparation and spending tons of money, but by running them, learning from your mistakes, and running them again. And there's that kind of iterative dimension of Silicon Valley that I found very interesting. So I started teaching the modern and the postmodern and was shocked. It had 30,000 people sign up for it. Shocked that many of these people had advanced degrees in the humanities. I was also a little frightened by that because I'd been teaching mostly first-year students in this class, and suddenly I had a lot of experts in the class. And what was really striking to me was that in addition to having students from in that class over 75 different countries, I had students who were dedicated to learning and so invested in the process of discussing these texts with one another on the discussion boards and with me when we had the opportunity to do so. But what happens in this kind of class is that I don't grade the papers because there are too many people. But when you submit a paper, you get five back and you give comments on those. And in that conversation you have with fellow students from around the world, you develop a multitude of perspectives on important issues. I should say, I really signed up to do the MOOC so I could say these are bad, you know, that I've tried it myself and it's not a good thing. And on the contrary, what I discovered was it was really one of the most exciting pedagogic experiences I'd had since I was in my 20s, because it was so enlivening every day to be interacting with people online from around the world around these key texts. And Wesleyan's professors who did this with me, I think we offered six to start out with, and one was in classics, one was in economics, another in statistics, another in film. So very different courses there, and you can find them all on Coursera. And all of us were surprised by the humane dimension of it, by the human interaction you had across great distances. I actually have offered a second class called How to Change the World. What it is about is six major global issues. We deal with climate change and sustainability, poverty and economic development, disease and global health, gender and education, so that students have more information about what we know about these global issues, why we should care about them. And then in this class, what we can do about them. And I should say one of the most striking things for me in giving this class is that people use the course in very different ways. So a middle school in Israel was using it as an e-textbook in a classroom, and they sent me some photographs of the kids watching the videos in their classroom. A graduate school of public health in Texas has used it. Women's University in South Korea has used it, and they use it in their own way. They don't use it how I set out for them to do it. They take what they want and make use of it for educative purposes. I think that's really exciting, and so I'm actually going to run the course again. It starts on November 11th, and it's at Coursera.org. And it's free. Anybody could take it. And students really do find a community online through which they can learn in a broad, contextual, and pragmatic way.
I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. In anticipation of his visit to Rhodes College on October 23rd, I'm speaking with Michael Roth about his new book, Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. Now, Michael, in talking about these MOOCs, what I'm really hearing is that what you're calling for is a broad, multifaceted approach to the kinds of problems that we're facing in higher education. And one of the things that I really loved about the book is while it's thoroughly in tune with appreciating the contemporary conversation, you're a historian, you're an intellectual historian. And so what you do is to provide this very robust defense of liberal education by going backwards and showing how this debate has unfolded, at least among some of the great articulators about what an education should be in America, going back all the way to the founding fathers. And you've already talked a little bit about Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin as kind of early antagonists, about what Franklin thought about elite colleges like Harvard, that they were out of touch and priggish and just produced pride and conceit. And Jefferson, who really is the first person you look to articulate a much broader vision of why a liberal education is important and talk about the role that he played in founding one of the great public universities, University of Virginia. Teleport us back a little bit more to that conversation amongst the founding fathers about the role of education in democracy. And if you would talk a little bit also about what the founding fathers thought about the role of government is in higher education.
It's an important question. Jefferson really thought that education was key for human freedom, that through education, one achieved a certain kind of autonomy. And through education, one learns the kinds of things that would enable you to resist oppression and to be independent. Jefferson, of course, one of the authors of the Declaration of Independence, is a key figure in the American Revolution and in the early years of the Republic. What Jefferson added to the conversation of his time was also a commitment to find people who can learn quickly and deeply, but who may not have the resources to have access to a quality education, find those people and educate them at the public's expense. He really thought, as he said, perhaps not politically correctly, I guess, in order, he said, we should rake the rubbish. You know, we should find people who are poor, but who have enormous talent. Because otherwise, the rich people will consolidate their hold on our resources, and they'll educate their own kids, and they will prevent the poor from getting education. And that will result in the solidification not only of a tyrannical government, but an increasingly inept one, because the rich will just try to serve themselves, and we won't have the infusion of talent that comes from finding people of great ability, but who may be, have been born to families without great economic development. Now, in those days, as there is today, resistance to raising taxes. So Jefferson's plea to rake the rubbish often fell on deaf ears because the wealthy people who were making the decisions didn't see the need to raise taxes. But he did have this commitment at the University of Virginia that it wouldn't just be a school for the rich, and that the public's interest was served by injecting into the highest realms of science, literature, social science, and the arts, people who come from modest backgrounds, because they will provide new talent and they will shake up the social hierarchy. So in those early days of the Republic, you see a commitment to education as a vehicle for social mobility, and the fear that education could become the cement of economic privilege. We've seen that happen in our own time, right, where a high cost of education means that if you're very wealthy, you may have easy access. But otherwise, education just cements that social privilege. It doesn't, in many cases, provide enough avenues for people of modest means to have access to high-quality education. The retreat of public support from higher education across the country in the last 15 years has been a catastrophic mistake, because places like Wesleyan can offer a lot of financial aid for people who don't have economic wherewithal to come, but we're too small to make a big enough dent on the country. It is the big public universities that have to remain accessible to the great majority of talented people in this country. What Jefferson, I guess, was blind to was that there are groups that he excluded from access to higher education: Native Americans, women, and especially Africans and African Americans. And one of the things that interested me so much about the research for this book was to see how African Americans in the middle of the 1800s seized on the Jeffersonian legacy that education was a key vehicle for freedom, even though they were criticizing Jefferson for his racism. So David Walker, who I write about in the book, is an extraordinary example of someone who said, I want my fellow black Americans to get an education. I don't want them asking white people for help. I want them to get an education so that they can overthrow the tyranny of slavery, so they can overthrow the tyranny of racism. And education, Walker thought, was the vehicle for freedom. He spoke in completely Jeffersonian terms, although he was rightly so critical of Jefferson because Jefferson didn't think black people could have the education that Walker clearly had himself and was calling for in others. And then there's that great moving story of Frederick Douglass, who as a young slave was taught to read and then heard his master yell at the master's wife, who had taught Douglass to read, and say, you can't teach this person to read. He didn't use the word person, but you can't teach this kid to read. He'll be unfit for slavery. Unfit for slavery if he reads. Now, that's such a great American phrase, right? If you get an education, you are unfit for slavery. And so Douglass said, of course, education should be the vehicle for freedom. He also knew you needed an education to get a job. Yeah, he also knew you had to have some education so you could support yourself economically. But we also have to remember that education, from the very beginning of this country and in its key battles over civil rights, education is a vehicle for freedom and a vehicle to resist oppression.
Now, one of the things that you do in the book is also trace the history of the way in which higher education has changed over time, such that we've almost become a nation of colleges. And part of what's ended up happening in college education more generally, at large institutions in particular, not so much at smaller liberal arts institutions, is an emphasis on professionalization and specialization. And even those of us who teach at smaller liberal arts institutions, we've been educated in accord with that highly specialized approach to education. At one point in the book, Michael, you almost sound caustic about the disconnect between that kind of education and the broad, integrative, pragmatic contextual education that you're an advocate for. So you write, a deep commitment to general education is impossible in a context in which faculty and students prize above all their ability to teach and study what they want. Should students not study what they want, and should professors not teach what they want? And I guess the bigger question is, given the way in which education works on the ground at large institutions, haven't we gotten to a point where the institutional inertia is such that we are actually beyond a liberal education already?
I don't think so. I think we may have slipped beneath it, but I think, in other words, we in many places have replaced the broad integrative learning that a professor should have with narrow specialization and the cult of expertise. This is really the bureaucratization of education, and it started happening in the late 1800s, and it's proceeded apace. Even schools that are dedicated to pedagogy wind up hiring professors whose pursuit of prestige depends on their ability to specialize. When you go to graduate school in most fields, whether it's in physics or in philosophy, in chemistry or in English, over time, you are asked to narrow your focus, to add to the wealth of knowledge by finding some very small topic and writing a long dissertation on it or a monograph on it. You hone your research skills that way. And although getting those skills is important, if those skills are not accompanied by a broad integrative approach to the subject and its relation to other disciplines, you become a distorted thinker. That is, you become less a thinker and more a bureaucrat of your own subject area. That may work if all you want to do is to produce articles that very few people will read but might get you a small raise at the end of the year from the university administration, but it doesn't work at all for undergraduates. Undergraduates are trying to understand how their in-depth work in chemistry or physics might be related to technology and the economy today. Undergraduates are trying to understand how the conflict between love and citizenship in a classic play would be relevant to their own feelings about their friends on campus and their obligations to their family or to their country. And professors are often able to speak to those needs of undergraduates, but it's despite their training in graduate school, not because of it. And so I think there has been some movement away from this. When Anthony Grafton was president of the American Historical Association, he spent a lot of time talking to chairs of graduate departments in history about the importance of not merely being a specialist. And Grafton is a great specialist. He knows more about certain topics than anybody in the world. But he is also able to relate his specialized knowledge to a wealth of other issues and concerns that matter to undergraduates.
And of course, this is important not only so that you can be a great teacher in the classroom and really turn on undergraduates to the world of ideas. It's also what underpins this chasm that's emerged between the kind of language that happens inside the university and in colleges and the broader public. In part, the result of this is this myth that there is an ivory tower and that the academy is somehow disconnected from the real world and real problems, when in actuality, that's not the case. And in part, that is what you are calling for in terms of reclaiming this notion of a liberal education. Michael, we'd really be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about what we might term the pantheon of great figures that you have recourse to, whose arguments you marshal. And you've already mentioned a number of them when you've talked about Jefferson and Franklin and Frederick Douglass and W.E.B. Du Bois. But the heart of your argument is that you really play off of an American pragmatic tradition. And pragmatic doesn't quite dovetail with instrumental and usable forms of knowledge. Tell us a little bit about pragmatism, about William James and John Dewey and Richard Rorty and Jane Addams and some of these other figures that you pull from in terms of your articulation of what a pragmatic liberal education is all about.
American pragmatism is our great contribution to Western philosophy, and I was happy to be able to write about some of my heroes in the book and people who've made such a decisive contribution to the way we think about the world in general. Let me just give a couple of points about each of those people you've mentioned. William James, for starters, I love to talk about this essay on a certain blindness in teachers, where he was addressing a group of teachers, and he talked about how easy it is for us to think we know how things look to another person, as long as we don't try to get in the other person's shoes. talks, he tells a story about riding through the countryside and thinking it's all been decimated by improper human activity and denuded of interest. And then his driver turns to him and says, isn't this wonderful? We're taming the forest. We're making this place a home for ourselves. We're creating our own towns, our own communities. And James is taken aback because he thought he understood what he was looking at, but he didn't realize that he wasn't trying to look at this from anyone else's perspective. And he realized that if the driver had saw William James sitting in his rooms at Harvard, happily reading his books, that driver would have thought, oh, poor guy, they must be forcing him to do this. Because we are often blind to the ways other people see the world. And for James, the reason to do that, to overcome our blindness, was certainly had to do with ethics and citizenship, but it also had to do with having a greater opportunity to develop habits of action that would be effective in the world, that would take into account a variety of perspectives and not just be parochial, not just be narrow. That emphasis on thinking as a way of developing habits of action, that's at the heart of pragmatism, and it's really at the heart of my description of pragmatic liberal education. What should happen in a college is you develop habits of action through thinking so that when you leave, you are able to tap into those habits of action. So Jane Addams, for example, tells the story of having learned too much literature. She's, you know, having spent too much time thinking about books and at some point realizing that she had, as she says, lumbered her mind with literature. Try to create new modes of inquiry by rejecting the common sense of the previous generation. And what appeals to me about that, about Dick Rorty's emphasis on instigating change and reshaping oneself, is that he emphasized that there is no final goal for education. There's no final truth with a capital T, or you don't discover your real self and then you're done. For Rorty, and this comes out of Dewey as well, what you get is more inquiry. You get more questions. When scientists finish an experiment, when it's really successful, it's not that they stop. They have new questions. A successful experiment leads you to new questions. And education should lead you to new forms of inquiry. And that's why in the conclusion of the book, I say, when it works, it never ends. When liberal education works, it never ends. Because what should happen is that you have new modes of inquiry that depart from the common sense of the previous generation. And I should just say by way of conclusion for that, I think that's what a lot of the critics of liberal education are fearful of. They want to reinforce the status quo. And a broad contextual education usually arouses the interest of people in attacking the status quo, or at least being critical of the status quo. When we talk about people getting narrow training, we're talking about people we want to fit into the way things are. A broad contextual education gives you the capacity for innovation, for the capacity to challenge the status quo.
Michael Roth, thank you so much for expanding the conversation about education in our community, for reminding us that perhaps there's some big problems with the status quo and that we need to initiate new ways of thinking about the conventions that already are at stake in our culture, but also specifically about the conventional wisdom when it comes to higher education. We very much look forward to hearing more of your provocations when you join us in Memphis on October 23rd at 6 p.m. at Rhodes College.
Thank you very much, Jonathan.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO FM. To listen to the show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.